What I really, well, for me, the question is, and I think this is a very difficult question to answer, is what do we think we have gained? What do we think we have gained from our focus on these non-competition objectives?
Continuing with the 1994 to now policy paper series that IRSA published as a contribution to the SALDRU South Africa at 30 Years of Democracy Conference, we will be discussing the policy paper on competition policy in South Africa from 1994 to now. Two competing approaches in South African competition policy, merger control and anti-cartel enforcement in South Africa, by Willem Boshoff. Since our democracy, South Africa's competition policy has received positive international attention. The Competition Act of 1998 was ahead of its time, recognizing that credible competition law and effective structures are necessary for an efficient functioning economy. It did this with the view to being fair to both consumers and producers. Consumers gained access to competitive prices and product choices from the international community, and producers, especially SMEs, were given equitable opportunities to participate in the economy. In Chapter 1, Section 2 of the Act, it states that the purpose of the Act is also to promote a greater spread of ownership, in particular to increase the ownership of historically disadvantaged persons. Beneath the surface, though, two diverging enforcement models have emerged. On the one hand, we see merger control becoming increasingly interventionist, shaped more by local policy preferences than by global economic norms. On the other hand, anti-cartel enforcement has largely followed a learning-driven, evidence-based path, although that too is beginning to shift. In today's episode, we unpack how these competing models affect the credibility, balance, and future direction of competition law in South Africa. Can a single framework accommodate both? And what are the stakes if it can't? Joining us is Professor Willem Boshoff from Stellenbosch University. Willem is a professor of economics at Stellenbosch University and co-director of the Center for Competition Law and Economics. I'm Margot G, and welcome to IRSA's podcast series. Welcome to our show, Prof.
Thanks, Margot.
Prof, you started off with a bachelor's in actuarial science at Stellenbosch University, continued with a master's degree at Oxford's Said, and then returned to Stellenbosch University for your PhD. Did you always know you wanted to be an economics professor? And what drew you to competition law?
No, I didn't know that I would be an economics professor. I was very much interested in business and in the economics of business. And after my undergraduate degree, I first studied economics at Stellenbosch and then followed that with more studies in management research at Oxford. At that stage, I was kind of torn between going into business academia and eventually the field of competition policy won me over to academia because you could study business from an academic perspective. And I think that's what I've been doing and that's what I enjoy doing since then.
Okay, and do you have any advice to young economists that are looking to careers in economics or competition law?
Well, I think the first to consider if you are still undergraduate is to try and get as much of a technical training, that means a math, stats training, as you can, because economics is quite quantitative. Not just from the theory side, but also in terms of the empirical work that we do. So that is typically a huge advantage if you can gain those skills early on. And then I think then it's important to think about choosing proper graduate training where you can get a relatively broad exposure to the main fields, micro, macro, and econometrics, which is nowadays available at most of the leading universities. And from there on, you need to decide the kind of direction that you want to take. Do you want to be an economist, practice as an economist, or do you want to use economics perhaps in a different career direction?
Okay, very helpful. So in your paper, you unpack the evolution of competition policy in South Africa. How would you describe the current state of South Africa's competition policy before we get into your paper?
Well, I think the South African competition regime is by now an established one. It's been in operation for almost 30 years. It is recognized internationally as an active and innovative regime in terms of the types of cases brought and the various areas that the cases are brought in terms of the whether it's mergers, abusive cases, cartel cases and the like. So South African competition legislation has led the world on a number of fronts. Our extensive use of what is called market investigations, for example, and the various ways in which we've dealt with COVID-19, say, in terms of excessive pricing, and the variety of interesting cartel cases and also merger cases. So the regime is respected internationally. There are a large number of economists working there. And I think we'll get into the details how competition policy is done. But in terms of the overall view among, if you think about the efficacy of policy institutions in this country, is that the Competition Commission is rather effective. It's one of the few relatively effective organizations enforcing policy.
So in your paper, you use a Bayesian decision framework to analyze two core areas of competition policy, merger control and anti-cartel enforcement. How have these emerged over time?
So competition policy has a few main areas of focus. So the biggest part of competition policy in this country and in most countries is merger control. So that's the area that deals with evaluating the mergers and acquisitions by large firms. And so you have to obtain approval for large transactions from our competition authorities. So that is a big area. Then you have abusive dominance cases, which are more specific, but these are typically involved cases where a firm is said to use its size and position in the market not to benefit consumers, but simply to stop its competitors from competing or potentially even exploiting customers directly. And then there is cartel enforcement, the third area, which deals with cases of price fixing, when firms talk to one another and decide to set prices rather than competing with one another. So that's the type of case. So what I've looked at I looked at merger control and I looked at anti-cartel enforcement, that first and third areas that I've mentioned, and how enforcement in these areas have evolved over time. And to try and understand what drives them, how important are what I call policy preferences, which is basically the preferences of the political decision makers in terms of driving decisions in that area, versus the importance of past evidence and international cases and research shaping or driving the direction that cases might take or the decision to investigate or pursue cases. I then kind of contrast or find two, what I call two paths for competition policy. The one, it seems we've got much more interventionist on the merger side. And it's not that that's not driven by evidence, but the decision to impose remedies on parties that want to merge, for example, appear to be increasingly driven by concerns that have little to do with competition, but much more to do with public interest issues and other issues. And then on the cartel front, it seems more a case of having, you know, the enforcement efforts having been led by what cases had been completed before or what the types of cartel cases that are being pursued internationally. You know, my sense is that and of course, there are exceptions, and I kind of present a little bit of a simplified version here, but of course, much more nuanced when you compare the two paths. But there is a sense in which one might think of two possibilities here. One where policy is driven by evidence and literature and previous cases, and one where the preferences of the policymakers almost trump that and push you to pursue cases or oppose cases, you know, particular transactions, because they they are opposed to that for from a particular perspective. And there's a choice to be made, because over time, especially because the one where the preferences drive it is for mergers, and because mergers are such a big part of competition policy, over time it really becomes difficult to maintain or keep policy preferences from also becoming critical drivers in the other areas of competition policy. So
okay.
That was the kind of, that's the evolution that I tried to capture in this overview paper.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And tell me, Prof, this evolution, is there a moment where things changed rapidly, or was it a gradual evolution over time?
It's mostly gradual, so because, of course, competition policy is conducted within a legislative framework, and the legislative process of adjudication, you know, slows things down quite considerably, because South Africa, like in many other countries, but perhaps even more so here, we have a tiered system of adjudication. So that means your first point of contact would be the Competition Commission. They have, in the case of, for example, large mergers, they cannot approve or block, but they can recommend approval or blocking to the Competition Tribunal, the second tier. The Competition Tribunal is something like a court. And so in the Competition Tribunal will then adjudicate, as they say, on large cases or on abuse complaints and things like that. And then a further port of call, recourse you have if you feel different about a certain tribunal judgment, you might go to the Competition Appeals Court. And even from the Competition Appeals Court, you can go to the normal. There are possibilities to going to higher courts. So some of these matters, especially the more complex matters, can take a long time, which means that enforcement and changes in enforcement also shows up slowly over time, right? So that evolution can be, it's more evolution than revolution, if you want. And you see that in merger control, there's a gradual increase in interventions. There are some, periods where you see perhaps a stronger or more discreet increase, perhaps following 2018, we had a few amendments to the Competition Act, which affects the way in which the competition authorities approach certain matters, which also show up in the data. But it has mostly been a matter of gradual change over these past best of three decades.
What about the anti-cartel enforcement?
So in the case of cartels, you also see an increase in the number of cases up to around, I forget the exact years, around 2015, 16, maybe it's a bit later. But you also see an increase, as you do for merger interventions, by merger interventions I mean where there are cases where you actually either stop a party from merging or conditionally allow them to merge, subject to them, you know, implementing certain conditions or certain remedies, as we call them. In both cases, you do see a rise. In the case of the cartel enforcement, that plateaus over the last 6 or 7 years. And so it is slightly different. In the paper, I discuss the drivers of this. In the case of cartel enforcement, you could make an argument that the plateauing that you see in the last part of the period that I investigate, that plateau is really a result of, partly a result of the success of cartel enforcement in the preceding periods, so that the likely discouraging firms to collude, so there are fewer cases, but also partly because the cases that authorities have started pursuing are often cases that are more complex in form. So there are various ways in which you can collude. It's not just the kind of hardcore ones. There's ones that we would think of, that these are like two competitors or three competitors getting together and fixing a price. But you can also collude in other ways or via a third party. And these kinds of complex ways, you know, require more investigation, and the cases are longer and so on. But part of my argument has been that the plateauing and the initial increase in cartel enforcement was driven by what transpired from the previous investigations and from cartels and so on. In the case of mergers, that increase was driven by a set of other factors, because it's not clear. I mean, if you look at some of my quantitative research with students of mine, you know, if you take the same case today, with similar features, a certain type of case, a merger, that case would be much more likely to attract opposition than it would 15 years ago. So that tells me nothing has materially changed in terms of the facts or the structure or whatever, but it is that there's a different view of the risks associated with the merger, and much of that centers on what can be called non-competition issues. So the learning issue, there's less of a learning effect there because it's not clear. There's no strong international evidence or research evidence suggests that firms have become more anti-competitive, and that a merger objectively seen is more likely to generate anti-competitive effects. So it's not that there's evidence for that. So it must be a change in policy views of what is considered to be problematic versus the cartel cases, where in fact it is likely, as the one investigation into a particular industry revealed other related forms of collusion, and that gave rise to further investigations, that type of learning that you see in cartels.
So Prep, this then begs the question for me in terms of how does our competition law compare with international experience, but also what opportunities have we missed? And as I hear you speak about the mergers and how the merger control is evolving, what structures in the law are allowing the merger control to evolve in this way?
Well, what certainly stands out when you look at South African merger control and the way, at least our legislation and also the enforcement of that legislation, is the increased concern with what is called public interest objectives or non-competition objectives. So traditionally, when you evaluate a merger in competition law, the concern is to decide whether on balance the merger is beneficial. That means beneficial to in the particular market or markets where the firm is operating. So yes, any merger is very likely to lead, is by definition leading to a greater concentration. In other words, there are fewer firms and the resultant firm is bigger, which may, under some conditions, have a negative effect in terms of availability and variety and prices. But there may also be benefits, large benefits in terms of efficiencies. And so traditionally, of course, there are counter arguments to the competition problems as well. But the focus is squarely on thinking about mergers from a competition perspective, because it's competition law. Of course, so competition law is not concerned with other social effects of mergers. They are dealt with in other areas of the law. But what we included originally in our Competition Act was a set of specific so-called public interest objectives against which mergers must also be evaluated in South Africa. And these deal with whether the particular merger affect employment, adversely affect small businesses, the competitiveness of a particular industry. So it's all sorts of broader issues. Now, those objectives, we had a very interesting discussion at the SALDRA conference where the paper was presented about these objectives. And of course, the original idea was that they were to be secondary, still secondary to the primary issue of competition. And they were there because there was a feeling that in post-apartheid South Africa, you cannot simply ignore these, you know, certain social features of our economy, and we want competition policy to help contribute to addressing some of those concerns, for good or bad. But what has happened, the original idea was that these would be very specific and narrow. And so what has happened over time was that those objectives have gained in prominence to such an extent that they are now, following the 2018 amendments, considered equal in importance to competition concerns, which of course takes us completely away from the international norm, right? So even in countries such as Europe, where there are also concerns, broader issues, for example, in the European Union, it is about How does the merger promote the integration of the single market, for example, across the different member states in the EU? So there are also particular non-competition objectives, but the competition matter is always central. And where we have now gone is to a world where these two things are now on equal footing, to the extent that a merger that raises no material competition objections can actually be blocked simply because it does not satisfy certain public interest objectives. And so this is a major issue. So we have in that sense moved quite far away from the international competition law. On the cartel front, not so much. On the cartel front, there is the bigger debate around characterization, which is, you know, because in cartels, typically in most jurisdictions, any form of collusion is so-called per se prohibited. You can't offer a justification. You can't say, well, we colluded, we talked, but this was not so bad, or this was actually good for X, Y, and it's not allowed. So economists' role in the cartel cases, at least in the investigation stages, are actually quite limited historically. But, you know, even so, you do need to at least look at agreements that, I mean, what is being prohibited is an agreement between competitors. But there are many other types of agreements in the economy that are not between competitors. Agreements between suppliers and manufacturers, or retailers or whatever. So a variety of those agreements, they don't, even though they're agreements, they're not between competitors. And so what's happened on the cartel front in recent years is a bit of a move where the authorities challenge various forms of agreements, arguing that these are in fact collusive. And economists have become involved there as well to try and sort that out, whether, you know, how to view an agreement. But that's just the direction. So the debate is perhaps a bit different from the international debates, but generally I think our cartel enforcement has been relatively aligned with what you see elsewhere. It's a long answer to your question.
Very insightful, Omar. Thank you. Mm. Thank you, Prof. So then what are the implications of a preference-driven competition policy for investor confidence and market dynamism in a low-growth economy like South Africa? What would the impacts be on our economic growth?
Well, so the problem is that a preference-driven policy is an uncertain one. It is one that creates uncertainty because the parties don't know. They cannot predict the outcome. So if the policy, so that's the first problem. So you don't know what direction the policy preference, you know, might go in a particular case. So that's the first issue. And that, of course, then has an impact on whether you wish to pursue and proceed with the transaction or not. So I think that is a problem to the extent that, you know, firms almost see merger control as a way for policymakers to extract certain things from large corporates, almost as an extra tax, rather than addressing genuine competition concerns. So I think there are huge costs to moving away from a merger regime that looks at competition and looks at evidence primarily, and that treats non-competition issues primarily. It also means that you lose, many transactions might not be pursued or abandoned because the merger control regime might be seen as too aggressive in that sense.
Okay, so you mentioned that we cannot ignore the social features of our history. If we look at other developments that have happened more generally, there has been a lot of media exposure about Minister Tau's transformation fund. What do you make of it? And how does this compare to private sector initiatives such as the Localization Support Fund? Could you tell us a bit about these?
Well, there's the transformation fund with which I'm more familiar. I mean, it's more of the same. Because now you are saying, well, so it's clearly the policy preference turning to empowerment, so a merger, any large merger must now think actively about empowerment considerations to get approved. Question is now, if there's a likelihood that the firm can make a huge contribution to a transformation fund, does that mean it can expect a lighter treatment somehow in terms of the transaction? So it creates two alternative or competing concerns or objectives, which I think undermines economically efficient and beneficial transactions. So I don't think that is, I mean, it just takes it further in that direction. And indeed, I mean, if we are concerned about transformation, we have a whole host of other legislation dealing with that in the first instance, which is the proper purview of other policymakers. And of course, there are other initiatives such as the private sector initiative that you mentioned, a lot of them that are trying to achieve the same thing through a different route. But it is not, it seems to me, problematic to link merger approval to these other kind of non-competition objectives, such as the one, even if it's a fund, as you describe.
The development of policy is very interesting. And when I read your paper, I really liked the point you made about the Tinbergen rule, which you say is from 1956, so certainly not new. And you say it states that optimal policy making requires one policy instrument for every policy goal. What would you say is the one area that needs the most attention right now for future research?
Well, like I said, the Tinbergen rule was originally, and it's the rule devised by Jan Tinbergen, he's a Dutch economist, and he was very influential in Dutch policy making. And it is, in fact, a rule that is better known in macroeconomics. You know, it's been often applied to things such as central bank and central banking monetary policy, where the argument is, well, what should the Reserve Bank or other central banks pursue? And this is the perennial question: should they pursue inflation stability or should they pursue growth? And of course, the point being, well, you cannot have two objectives and you only have one policy instrument. Policy instrument, I mean, in their case, it's the repo rate or the interest rate. Now, in the case of competition policy or merger control, you have one instrument. That is, you approve, you allow the merger or not. That's your policy tool. It's the adjudication process. If that adjudication process now has to meet two competing objectives, it cannot be effective. So because in the one hand, if you want to allow a merger because it is not harming competition or may in fact be promoting competition at best, and the same merger might be harming or adversely affecting a social metric or one of the metrics that you're concerned with in your non-competition investigations, then how do you decide? So it's not possible for you to pursue both of these goals with your single instrument. So I think that is a major problem that's not recognized as much in micro policy making, regulatory policy making, as it is recognized in macro. So I think that is something to think about. And what are the costs? What are really, well, for me, the question is, and I think this is a very difficult question to answer, is what do we think we have gained? What do we think we have gained from our focus on these non-competition objectives? Seems to me we've not gained much. We certainly haven't advanced transformation in any significant way. We haven't really protected employment in any significant way. Most of those remedies are static employment protection. So it's kind of jobs that have to go because the company wants to become efficient and now the company must keep the particular job opportunities in place because it's required to keep them, right? So these are anyway, so it's not an efficient process. And at the same time, you're losing beneficial mergers that might create a lot more job opportunities. So it's not clear to me what the costs have been. And very difficult because you can't measure foregone opportunities, right? But that would be fascinating to see. Much more than simply worrying about cutting red tape in the economy, as we kind of say, well, we want to cut regulatory restraints. But this is a major issue in corporate decision making, how competition authorities go about dealing with transactions, and in terms of pursuing other kinds of cases like cartel cases. A lot of the cartel cases are settled. That means a settled case is a case that doesn't go to court. So it's never fought in court. So we don't know whether those allegations were actually true. It seems to us that a lot of companies simply settle with the commission to get it out of the way, even though they are very likely not contravening the law. So it is, you're dealing with a situation where a lot of these actions are potentially imposing costs on companies rather than really promoting the effective functioning of the economy. But it is a matter, and I have a lot of respect for colleagues that work on the other side, but would say, well, you know, there are a host of competition problems in South African economy. I think I wouldn't dispute that there are. It just seems to me we are not properly focusing on those concerns.
It's very interesting, just the notion of measuring opportunity cost. And as you were speaking, I remembered my first year economics of maximizing welfare for the economy, and competition is a huge part of that. I look forward to any future research that comes out in this space. It's very interesting. Thank you, Prof. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No. Well, just to encourage people to consider the field if there are budding economists that are interested in economics. And a lot of, I mean, you know, if you think about the economics discipline, there are a lot of good development economists in this country, and they run very good research programs, but there are not that many economists, you know, industrial economists like myself, or competition economists, if you want to call it that. And this is a field, I think, that's very interesting and relevant to promoting rivalry and promoting innovation in the South African economy. And I think it's a field worth thinking about if you're a young economist.
Definitely. And I think a space where there will be a lot of change with the likes of AI and all the digital innovation that is happening. So fast-moving space. Thank you, Prof. I really appreciate having the opportunity to have you on our show.
Thanks, Margot.
Great. And of course, a big thank you to our listeners. If you would like to learn more about this research, please follow the links on this podcast landing page on the IRSA website. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe to our socials on LinkedIn and Twitter. This is your host, Margot G. from the IRSA podcast series. Till next time.